Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us today are The Times' very own James Gearbrant, who we'll speak to later, and right now, the chief football writer, Henry Winter. Later on, we'll look ahead to another busy weekend of Premier League action, which includes a mouth-watering tie as Tottenham travel to the champions, Manchester City. But first, to the Super Cup. Liverpool beat Chelsea 5-4 in a penalty shootout after the tie finished 2-2 after extra time. So, Henry, what does that win mean, do you think, for Liverpool?
Well, I think it keeps the momentum, their love of Europe. I mean, you saw the amount of fans they had out there. It was about 6,500 throughout from Merseyside. And then it just showed how huge they are, as if we needed reminding, how huge they are around the world, because Liverpool fans literally flew in from all over the world. So I think that was just a reminder to the club, if they needed reminding, of this huge interest and passion there is for Liverpool. I think it showed, you know, on the sort of negative side, and Gregor being a former player would be far more technically equipped to explain it than I would, but there's still things that need working on in the defence. I mean, Jurgen Klopp was on the touchline going spare with his defence in the first half, particularly when Pulisic was running at them and Kante was running midfield. I think the main thing they take from it, apart from another trophy and a chance to update the champions wall at Melwood, is how much they need Firmino. Because when Firmino came on at half-time, he tilted the balance back towards Liverpool, because Jorginho had been playing, obviously, as he does. He'd been playing deep. He was getting things ticking over. Whereas Firmino, when he came in that sort of false nine position for Liverpool, he sort of squeezed the space a little bit around Chelsea's sort of deep-lying central midfielders like Jorginho. And then the other two up front for Liverpool, as we saw so spectacularly last season, Sadio Mane and Mo Salah, they were in their best positions and they were flying again. So, I mean, Firmino is just so important. I mean, when he created a goal within 3 minutes, he was that work rate he's got, the pressing, the touch, the movement, everything about him. He's, you know, he's one of the best players in the world.
Henry there mentioned, Gregor, that obviously you were a former player. So maybe you can give us your take on it from a professional standard. Have we learned anything more about both of these sides?
It's interesting that Henry brought that up about the defence. It seems to be, in the last three games, it has been an issue. It does seem that Liverpool are playing a higher line. Everyone's discussed that. And they do seem to be getting played through a little bit more easily. And it was interesting in Paul Joyce's piece today that Liverpool have faced 40 shots in their opening three games, compared to half of that in their opening three games last season, against lesser opposition, albeit. But there does seem to be, it does seem noticeable that they're playing a higher line so far this season, and they're not entirely comfortable. You can see this even on the looks on Van Dijk's face and all the players' faces. They don't seem quite happy with that setup so far.
Yeah, definitely. And fair play to Frank Lampard. He noted that. He brought Tammy Abraham on in the second half, and you know, his pace, he was getting behind that defence. As you say, they had a high line. I still think they're trying to sort of work out. I mean, it's a nice option to have, but who should play alongside Van Dijk? Matip, as we saw towards the end last season, looks a very good combination. Joe Gomez is obviously sure. I got the impression, I was in the press conference afterwards, I got the impression that Klopp played Gomez at right back because he wanted someone who's more sort of defensively sound than Trent Alexander-Arnold. Look, who's a good fullback, and we know how good he is going forward. So I still think there's a sort of little bit of juggling to do in that defence. But you know, one or two issues, obviously Alisson being unfortunately injured for sort of 5 or 6 weeks. But, you know, so that natural understanding that they would have and they built up last season obviously wasn't there so much, particularly in the first half. But look, Adrian's a good goalkeeper. And when you've got a player like Virgil van Dijk, who is just, you know, just an awesome, probably the best centre-half in the world, then I don't think that people are going to be panicking too much. But Klopp is such a perfectionist. You could see the way he was shouting at his defence in the first half. But again, as ever with these things, we focus on the negative. We've also got to celebrate how good Chelsea were, particularly in the first half with Kante running the show. Pulisic, who's very young, but you know what a talent he looks, particularly coming in off the left and sort of working between the lines as he did for Giroud's goal. So, yeah. But look, there's clearly work to be done for Liverpool.
I don't necessarily want to focus on the negatives, but I'm going to have to bring up a point that Tony Cascarino made in the Times today, where he's spoken about Chelsea's youngsters, in particular Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham. He says they're simply not yet ready, that they need experience alongside them. I mean, for me, Mason Mount in the last two games for Chelsea has been particularly impressive.
I agree.
And I was a bit surprised that he has singled them out in the sense of saying they're not yet ready.
Perhaps he means not ready to be sort of relied upon. Chelsea definitely looked far better. And I think Frank Lampard deserves a lot of credit for the way he set up the team. It was an intelligent approach after a 4-0 defeat, which was a hugely chastening start for a manager. But I think, yeah, I think I agree. I think Mason Mount, certainly when he came on, he was very unlucky not to get a goal. And Tammy Abraham, he missed the penalty. That'll knock his confidence a little bit. But I think this season is going to be make or break for him. He's got an opportunity to play regular football, and I think he's got to take it, because he's flourished at championship level, scored lots of goals, but he's not quite done it in the Premier League yet. And I think that one is a little bit more open to interpretation, to see what happens in the future.
Henry, we know, of course, that Frank Lampard is going to have to use some of the younger players at Chelsea right now. But where do you stand on Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham from what you've seen so far of them?
Well, I think Chelsea's best two players in pre-season were Mason Mount and Ross Barkley. Ross Barkley, obviously, slightly older. I think Mason Mount's a fantastic talent. I thought he was good at Old Trafford. I think it wasn't just Lampard who was surprised by Jose Mourinho's criticism of Mason Mount. I thought, as Gregor was saying, he was excellent when he came on in arguably a sort of slightly unfamiliar position, out and cutting in. I just think he's a terrific young prospect. And I think the important thing for Chelsea is they've got these options. I mean, everyone sort of rewinds back to Alan Hansen's comment, you won't win anything with kids. And obviously, the class of 92 were fantastic. The class of 92, you had a lot of experience alongside them as well. And I think Mason Mount will learn, Tammy Abraham will learn. I mean, look, things might have been different for his confidence if that incredible shot against Manchester United had been 1 inch to the right and gone in rather than hitting the post. Mm. So, look, we can't spend all our life saying, Chelsea got to start playing these players. They've got this fantastic academy. Isn't it great if they can actually sort of cross the road and get involved in the first team? And the first sign of them not necessarily delivering in a game, saying, right, let's send them back to the creche. Got to give them a chance, particularly Mason Mount. I really do think he is a first-team Chelsea player for a few years to come. Tammy Abraham, as Gregor says, you know, there are things he's got to work on and he's finishing. But that pace is frightening. His attitude is the highest class. And I think he's got a future at Chelsea, definitely. But, you know, let's give him a few games. But I quite like the way that Frank Lampard played it in the build-up. He kept talking about youth. He kept talking about N'Golo Kante having an injury concern. And then he went with an experienced team, with Kante playing one of his best performances for Chelsea in recent years. So I think, look, Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham will definitely get games. And the great thing is that I think that shows Chelsea fans, some of them at the airport, they're really upbeat. You know, the second successive defeat, whether it's a defeat, it's a draw or whatever, they could see that Lampard, they liked the way that Lampard was getting them to play. They liked the fact he was playing one or two mind games in the press conference. They liked the way that he sort of changed it and would bring some young players on. And the fact that despite all this sort of, you know, the headlines or whatever, and it's going to be interesting when they've got this appeal, whether they can actually get one of the transfer windows back, because they'll clearly use the Manchester City precedent, the fact that they got away with the fine. I know as Martin Ziegler was writing in the Times today, it's slightly different offences, but I think it might only be a one window ban. So then Lampard can go again. But look, in terms of young talent, I know it's not homegrown, but Pulisic looks a real star. So I think there'll be a blend going forward of experience and young players.
Henry, from Liverpool's point of view, Oxlade-Chamberlain had a pretty difficult first half. Firmino really changed the game for them when he came on in the second half. What do you think the future holds for Oxlade-Chamberlain? What do you think is his best position in that team for Liverpool?
Central midfield, pushing on. I just think that when he picks up the ball, he gives any teams something a bit different. That ability to run with the ball, to get beyond defenders. I think he's got that natural enthusiasm. I thought he started to wide left last night, and yeah. I didn't think it particularly suited him. But I think also he's coming back from a very serious injury. And look, you'd know yourself, it takes a little bit of time, whether it's a confidence thing. I mean, he's a naturally very ebullient, intelligent individual anyway. But I think that will take a bit of time. But also, if you play him in the centre, that is an area that Liverpool really need to strengthen. I mean, they were hoping that Naby Keita would be the answer to fit in there, that sort of dynamic goal-scoring midfielder. Not quite a Gerrard, but sort of producing some of those sort of bursts in the energy and the goals. Naby Keita is looking a little bit brittle physically, and he's got to show that he can string a run of games together. I think Oxlade-Chamberlain, obviously, has had that bad injury. But I think if he a fit, sharp, firing Oxlade-Chamberlain with his pace restored is a starting midfielder for Liverpool.
And Gregor, let me ask you then, how important is Sadio Mane to this Liverpool team?
Well, I think we saw he's vital, and there's obviously been a lot of worry this summer and in recent weeks about the length of his holidays. I think for the last 7 years he's not had much more than 20 days holidays. Yeah. God almighty, I couldn't imagine. I desperately needed my 2 months holiday every summer. So yeah, he's just rapier quick. He's just a real threat for Liverpool, and a different sort of proposition to anyone else they have, I think, in that front three. So they're really going to hope that he stays fit and healthy and he's firing all cylinders this season.
And I suppose, Henry, we need to talk about Adrian and the piece that you've written about adding his name to that list of Liverpool's Istanbul heroes. His Liverpool career, quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's absolutely superb. I mean, it's come about in unfortunate circumstances, and it was quite emotional when Alisson was limping around the pitch the other night against Norwich City, having got injured, because he's so loved by the players, by the supporters, and Klopp obviously gave him a huge hug. So I think everyone would wish him a speedy recovery. But Adrian's shown in shootouts before. I think it was a point that Joycey was making in the Times about the fact that he's done it for West Ham. I think he even scored against Everton in a shootout as well. So he's clearly a confident individual. I thought the penalties were all sort of pretty impressive. Again, coming back to Mason Mount, that was quite nerve-wracking, particularly with Adrian on the line, bouncing around, trying to do a Jerzy Dudek or Bruce Grobbelaar. We're talking Liverpool goalkeepers of yesteryear. And Mason Mount kept his cool. But no, Adrian he's also, from what everyone says, he's actually quite a sort of strong character. You could see the way he was celebrating afterwards, in the dressing room as well, when Liverpool released some footage from in there. So absolutely, Alisson is a miss because he's in the top three goalkeepers in the world. But Adrian's a pretty impressive understudy.
And there have been a lot of calls, Henry, about this game suggesting we could actually have a 39th Premier League match as a result of seeing Liverpool take on Chelsea on foreign soil. Where do you stand on that? Do you think this was a good advert, that there is a possibility of having that 39th game?
Well, it's a fantastic advertisement for English football. You've got two teams going for it over 2 hours and then an absorbing penalty shootout. I mean, it certainly wasn't a friendly. It was very competitive. There was a sort of mix of fans in the stadium, of the sort of the English fans who travelled out, and then fans from all over the world. So the Premier League would have looked at that. Okay, it's a UEFA event, but they would have looked at that and thought, wow, can you imagine if we could stage this on a regular basis? I have been absolutely against the 39th game from the word go, the moment Scudamore suggested it, and it really damaged Scudamore's reputation, not simply amongst journalists like me and Paul Hayward and Ollie Holt, people like that who were having a go at him for even contemplating it, but amongst fans amongst, I mean, even if Seth Blatter considers a plan too greedy, you know that it's really beyond the pale. I think it's offensive to the fans who are the lifeblood of the games, i.e. the match-going fans in this country, going to matches through thick and thin when their team's struggling. They're the ones who go. So suddenly, for the Premier League to say, oh, actually, the Manchester derby is going to be in Manila this year because we can make a lot of money there, and their fans out there, the two clubs, that's fine. But let them see them on, you know, if Manchester United or Manchester City go on tour and play in one of these sort of pre-season competitions out there, then fair enough. That's where the Premier League can do it. But we can't become like the NFL and move franchises around, which will be the next thing. Having said that, you look at the owners, you look at the background of a lot of them in American sports. You look at the desire for money, wages going up, transfer fees going up. They want to sort of, you know, cover their costs on that. They look at what's happening with the European Clubs Association in terms of them wanting to expand the Champions League. I can see the 39th game very much coming back on the horizon, and we've got to fight it.
Just one last thing on the Super Cup, and in some ways I don't want to talk about it, but have to make mention of the referee, Stephanie Frappart, the first female to take charge of a major men's game in terms of a final. A great performance overall, really, from her, Henry.
Terrific performance. Physically, she kept up with a high-tempo English game over 2 hours, under a lot of pressure, under a lot of scrutiny. I mean, well, when the announcement was made, everyone was getting very excited, and a lot of us just shrugged. I mean, we know she's a good referee. We saw that in the Women's World Cup final. I don't think the quality of refereeing, certainly in England at the moment, and in certainly parts of Europe, is that great. So any help is absolutely vital. I would love to see her referee in the Premier League. I can't see it happening, but I would love to see her go to Champions League final. It is the 21st century, the last time I looked. Why can't someone as talented as her? What I thought was interesting, and maybe it was a compliment to her, is that there was actually a little bit of dissent from the players. It was like, this is such an intense game, and they did turn on her a little bit. But actually, all her decisions were good. I thought the Tammy Abraham decision was, I thought she slightly gambled on it with Adrian's challenge. I mean, I don't see how she could necessarily have told that there was contact, how much contact there was. But then VAR obviously decreed that it wasn't a clear and obvious mistake. Yeah. So, you know, they went with her call. So I thought that was great.
Henry, what do you
think? Played a lot of advantage.
What's your feelings about that? I mean, I think any of us who watched the replays would think it's not a penalty. But because of the clear and obvious factor, they not to overturn the decision. And when you contrast that with the offside ruling at the weekend with Raheem Sterling, which doesn't need to be clear and obvious, and that's so kind of factual and based on millimetres, what do you feel? That feels like a bit of an inconsistency there.
There's a complete inconsistency. You're completely right. And I think it's going to take a season for the individual competitions to get their consistency right, but also to have an element of consistency between different competitions. Because I mean, we were sitting in the press box last night going, is VAR actually here? Little evidence of it so far. And when it is applied, it's applied differently from in the Premier League. I think it's going to be confusing for some of the players when they do step from Premier League-style refereeing on it into the Champions League. I think eventually it will all calm down. I think that we've got to have technology in this game. Again, it's, you know, it is the 21st century. It is ridiculous that the one person in the stadium who has the most important decision to make, the referee, doesn't have immediate access to, like, the fans are streaming. I've got a monitor in front of me. The broadcasters have. So I think it's important, but it's just a balance. Personally, I would love there to be a one-minute rule, so the decision cannot be made within a minute. Then you go with the umpire's call, as they call it in cricket. So, look, it needs to be... I mean, the sympathy I have, obviously, as fans of the stadium, they need proper communication, absolutely. But also, with the players, when do players celebrate? There's another issue. If you have a sort of three-minute wait, like you did at one of the matches at the weekend, it was a City game, then what are the players doing? Are their muscles going to stiffen? This is a long, old season with a lot of games. And, you know, if we've got players going down, so having pulled a hamstring because they've waited 3 minutes and have, you know, not kept warm. Are managers going to put bicycles on the side of the pitch as you get in sort of some sports, and just tell the players to sort of come off and just sort of keep ticking over while VAR makes its decision? We can't have those sort of breaks. So if it's a minute and they can do it quicker, but there's one final thing they've got to address: the quality of officiating, particularly in England over the last sort of 7-8 years since the Webb-Clattenburg era, has not been great. So we need to invest more money in that as well as in technology.
And you mentioned the celebrations there. One last point on the whole VAR debate. The winning penalty kick, I mean, there was pictures on social media that came out and we saw. So imagine, obviously that's not clear and obvious, so by the current rules that should not have been brought back. But imagine that moment with Klopp running off down the line and all the players running to celebrate with Adrian, who had an amazing moment for him. Imagine that had been pulled back. And by the letter of the sort of the ruling, it should have been. It just doesn't feel like it's quite, as you say, it'll take time to get up to speed, but there are inconsistencies there, and really they're sort of defining the football matches still.
Yeah, and I mean, our players going to have to celebrate twice. It's very strange. I mean, you've been there. You must know when you've scored a goal or one of your teammates
scored
a goal. That, sure. Well, it makes it even more important, that instant celebration. We cannot take that away from players and just turn football into a laboratory.
Henry, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Henry. Really appreciate that.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, so it's all looking very rosy for Liverpool right now, but is everything okay north of the border, Gregor? Celtic unexpectedly crashed out of Champions League qualification. They lost to Dan Petrescu's Romanian champions, FC Cluj. I don't know where to begin with Celtic in Europe, but recently, Gregor, it's not been a very happy tale for them.
No, this is the fourth time in the last six seasons, I believe, that they've not made it to the Champions League proper. And in that time, they've lost qualifiers to Legia Warsaw, Malmo, Maribor, AEK Athens. These are not clubs that really strike fear into the heart of most of Europe's strongest teams. And that's the thing. Celtic have a history and a heritage of being among the big clubs in Europe. And the sad fact is that's no longer the case. The one thing is all those clubs, the disparity, the financial disparity between Celtic and Europe's richest clubs now is huge. But the same can be said for all those opponents who they've lost to. I believe that the combined playing budget for all 14 teams in the Romanian top flight is still less than Celtic's.
Wow.
So that kind of gives you an idea of how sort of embarrassing that defeat was. I think also when Celtic do reach the group stages, I think in the last two seasons in six that they did qualify, they won one in 12 games, and there were defeats like 5-0, 7-0, and 7-1. So that's really pretty striking. And I think Celtic can no longer really be classed as a Champions League level football club. That's very tough.
Strong.
That's tough to say. Yeah, I mean, I was brought up a Celtic fan as well, so it's not easy for me to say that. And I think the other thing is we have to sort of be wearisome of the fact that Rangers are certainly improving under Steven Gerrard. When Neil Lennon replaced Brendan Rodgers was always going to be very hard to replace, but Neil Lennon felt like a bit like a step back into the past rather than into the future. And there were some big talking points from the defeat on Tuesday. He left £10 million worth of defenders on the bench. That's a lot of money for Celtic to have spent. And played Callum McGregor at left back, who's one of their most sort of dynamic attacking midfielders, and it just did not work. So there are sort of the early rumblings of discontent about Neil Lennon, and obviously there is the spectre of 9 in a row and 10 in a row on the horizon, and it is true to say if you offered Celtic supporters the choice of Champions League qualification this year, next year, and the year after that for a 10 in a row, they would take the 10 in a row right now. So as sort of prestigious as it is to get into that Champions League group stage and play against all the European greats, that is a real kind of carrot dangling on the horizon for Celtic, and that's the thing. But it's going to be tough to get there now, because Rangers are, like I say, they're in the ascendancy.
Well, Dan Petrescu is unhappy that his side, who, as we mentioned, are the Romanian champions, are having to actually go through qualifying to reach the group stages. He thinks that UEFA should consider a change in the format. Likewise, you could suggest that Celtic, Scottish champions, they've had to start their season very early to get through ultimately and fail in the Champions League qualification. Do you think Dan Petrescu is sort of right with what he's thinking, that all champions perhaps should be getting through to the group stage proper?
Absolutely, but the likelihood of it happening is very slim, because, I mean, if anything, the opposite is going to happen. There's huge talks about sort of solidifying the places in this elite competition for the biggest clubs in Europe, regardless of where they finish in the league. That's the direction of travel, rather than worrying about clubs the size of, well, not the size of, but from the leagues the size of Scottish football and Romanian football. So absolutely, the teams who win their titles in their country should be in this competition. But that's not the direction of travel, so it's not going to happen anytime soon.
And the other disappointing factor in all of this is that Celtic going out early, coupled with Kilmarnock as well, failing in their European bid this season. I know you've still got Rangers and Aberdeen in Europa League qualification, Celtic dropping into the Europa League as a result of their defeat, but it does affect the coefficient for Scottish teams because of their performances in general in Europe recently. They're not doing the business, therefore that's only why they have one team in the Champions League, for
Absolutely.
Example.
Yep, it's not going to make that any better or any easier for the future. And it's not going to do any good for Celtic's finances either, although they have been run very prudently. In recent years, I think they've got about £40 million in the bank in the last accounts. Obviously, the sale of Kieran Tierney brought in another £25 million. I realise people were saying that's kind of that money gone.
Chris Sutton, one of those.
Yes. No surprise there. That's almost true. But Celtic have brought in like about £100 million in recent years from player sales. And their turnover is about £100 million. And Rangers are the next closest with about £30 million turnover. So their dominance in Scotland, their sort of the size of that football club, they really have very little to complain about when they're talking about European sort of their how small they are in comparison now to some of the European giants.
Let's take a look at one of the standout fixtures in the Premier League this weekend. Manchester City host Tottenham on Saturday evening. James Gearbrandt now joins us. It is the first time, let's not forget, that the teams have met since last season's incredible Champions League, which saw Raheem Sterling's winner ruled out by VAR, so not a winner. There is an assumption that it is always good to get some of the big teams out of the way at the beginning of the season. West Ham might well argue against that after their opening day 5-0 loss at home to City. James, have City shown already they are the team to beat then this season?
My view is that City sort of came into the season as very much the team to beat. I mean, I do feel that they are the strongest team in the league. And yes, I suppose you'd have to say that their opening day performance kind of was impressive and sort of confirmed our impression of them as a sort of, you know, attacking juggernaut, a team that so many ways to, a team that are just so good at creating chances. Hypothetically, you sort of might always think it's better to play teams at the start of the season. And I guess sort of logically there is probably something in that, because teams, I guess, kind of get up to speed through the season and you sort of rehearse those little combinations, particularly in City's case. But I do think City look, I think that they're quite a formidable team to face even at this early kind of stage.
James, from Tottenham's perspective, last weekend against Aston Villa, they were kind of transformed in the second half with the introduction of Christian Eriksen. Obviously, his future's still a little bit up in the air, but do you think really Tottenham's chances of success will hinge on whether or not he is going to start or not, and whether he's in the sort of the right frame of mind to do so?
Yes, I think that's fair, particularly as I think Son and Dele Alli are both out, I think I'm right in saying. I do think that that Eriksen will be important in this game.
And what about Tottenham themselves then? Do you think they need to make a statement so early on in this season to sort of prove to everybody else that they are title challengers?
I'm sort of a bit wary of the idea of sort of statement wins. I think it's sort of very sort of tempting to think that, you know, when the big teams meet, you know, that's kind of, that those matches are sort of really decisive in the title race. But I think actually kind of the real lesson of the past few seasons is that actually titles are really sort of won by relentless form across the 38-game season, and I suppose particularly against the kind of non-elite teams. You know, it's about just really remorselessly kind of racking up points. I mean, for one thing, Man City already know that, I mean, Tottenham beat them, you know, a few months ago. So I don't think that if Tottenham to win this game, it would necessarily sort of be a kind of big quantum shift.
Well, what about Manchester City and what you've seen of them then from their first game in the Premier League, that thumping 5-0 win over West Ham? Some were surprised that Bernardo Silva didn't certainly start for Manchester City. Are you surprised that he wasn't in that starting 11?
I'm not hugely surprised, to be honest. We know that Pep does this, don't we? We're all kind of really familiar, I think, with Man City's squad depth and Pep's kind of sort of unique way of marshalling it, you know, the so-called Pep roulette. Although I do think I would sort of expect Bernardo to start this game, because I think he's part of their Guardiola's kind of strongest 11. But I do think we'll continue to see Pep sort of rotate and surprise. And I actually think, you know, we could see some really quite funky stuff from Pep this season. So,
ooh, I like that funky stuff.
I think it was interesting that Pep said after the weekend's game that the sort of the competition between Silva and Mahrez is going to be something that's really important to keep and for every player in every position to have someone who's chomping at the bit to get into the team to maintain the high standards that they've set in the past two seasons. And I think that's really interesting. I think Mahrez obviously took his opportunity and was a real handful against West Ham, and so now it's probably going to be over to Silva. And it's the same for every player. They've got to perform, or else there's someone of real quality waiting on the sidelines to take their chance.
That is quite interesting, because I wasn't aware of that quote, but I sort of, you wouldn't necessarily think that Bernardo Silva would sort of be in direct competition with Mahrez. I think obviously I expect Mahrez is going to play a lot this season, given that, you know, Sané is out with an ACL injury, and you might expect Bernardo to play more in the sort of, and he certainly has played. We know that Pep has deployed him on the wing on a few occasions, but you sort of might see his kind of front line position more as being one of those, the 3-8 roles, the sort of the slightly more advanced of the three central midfielders. So yeah, I'm slightly intrigued by that quote. I wasn't aware of it.
Well, James, we appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, Natalie. Cheers, Berger.
We've still got a little bit of time, so why don't we just focus on the EFL that's coming up this weekend. And Gregor, what are you looking out for?
Leeds United have again started the season really full of promise, and Bielsa has got them playing with exactly the same tempo and dynamism. They were unfortunately not to beat Forest last weekend. I think they nicked a point for us, definitely. And Leeds go to Wigan this weekend, so it'll be very interesting to see if they can continue in that form. Also, we have two of the relegated teams from the Premier League facing up on Friday night. Huddersfield play Fulham. And Huddersfield have had a very difficult time without a win in all competitions since February. They lost to Lincoln City in the Carabao Cup on Tuesday night, which followed defeat to Derby on the opening day, and a draw against QPR at the weekend. So I think Jan Sievert's possibly soon going to be coming under a little bit of pressure. And he's actually quite, if you, I don't know if you noticed, he's quite spiky in the press afterwards. He kind of had almost a little bit of a fallout with Liam Rossignol, who's joined Derby, of course, after the game, after the defeat on the opening day. So he's not a great loser, it doesn't seem, and he's actually doing quite a lot of it, unfortunately. He walked into a hard job, don't get me wrong, but Huddersfield have added to the squad, and they're expected, with the parachute payments and just having been relegated, they're expected to be up there, and it's been a difficult start for them. So it's going to be a difficult game against Fulham too, who have got probably the best squad in the Championship.
With regards though to Huddersfield, I mean, they've lost Aaron Moy, haven't they? That's a big miss.
A big loss, yes. He's a Premier League player though, and it was kind of surprising that he hadn't left over the summer anyway. I think he was probably, of all the players in the Premier League, he was the one who stepped up the most and looked the most comfortable on that at that level. So it's no surprise that he's left. But certainly they have other problems. They're not really scoring goals, and certainly against Derby they looked shambolic at the back. Some of the goals they conceded were really, really poor. So they're going to have to rectify that pretty quickly.
Big game then for Huddersfield. And there was an announcement earlier on today from League Two that Sol Campbell has left Macclesfield after 8 months in charge. Took over in November 2018. The club were in all sorts of trouble. But, Greg, I mean, he did enough to steer them well clear in the end.
Yeah, I think anyone who is going to be giving Sol Campbell any sort of stick for throwing in the towel here really should check themselves, because it's been an unenviable set of circumstances. Players were very rarely paid on time. Some are still owed their salaries from over the summer and previous months. The owners there are sort of one of the most perplexing in the whole Football League. I think there seem to be, who knows what their agenda is. They don't really seem to have any interest in the running of the football club, and they put out a very strange statement just the other day, sort of criticising the players who have supported a winding up order, because they've still not been paid. But these are guys who are playing in League Two on very modest salaries, who can't pay their rent or are running into debt, and they need their money. So the football club, really, it was very strange for them to come out and criticise and name the six individuals who've supported this case. And I don't know whether that was the final straw for Sol Campbell, but I mean, he was backed in the signing of some players on deadline day. But I think he probably recognises that this is going to be another uphill struggle. And last season was a minor miracle, really, to keep them up with one of the smallest budgets in the league, and from the position he found the team when he joined in November. So I don't think there should be any criticism of Sol Campbell for this. And I think he's actually done enough in his time in that job to show that he deserves another opportunity in better circumstances too.
Well, yes, we'll see what happens then with Sol Campbell, as we will with Macclesfield. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, James Gearbrand and Henry Winter.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. We'll be back on Monday with all the fallout from the weekend's action.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.